Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podbean.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, July 6th, 2008, and this is show number 159. Well, this was a weird week, and I mean weird with a capital W. So get this. Kyle gets it in his head that he should buy a Tiffany bracelet for his girlfriend's 16th birthday. I explain to him that he'd never get rid of her if he does that, but the boy just doesn't listen, you know. He's 17. What can he do? Well, anyway, remember I told you that I use Twitter as my lookup service? So I Twittered, "Where's the nearest Tiffany?" Not really expecting an answer because people live all over the place and didn't figure they'd be able to make the connection where the closest one to me was. But a few seconds later, up pops a chat from crazy listener James telling me to go to Santa Monica because I could have lunch with him if I did that. Lunch? With crazy listener James? He's got to be crazy. So that's exactly what Kyle and I did. Yep, Kyle and I had lunch with James, and then he took us on a tour of MGM, where he works. He took us to the top floor where they had tons of real Oscars and these awesome photos of old-time actors. Like, one of them was actually a picture of The Lion doing the recording. It was so cool. But then he took us to the sixth floor where he sits, and there was no one on the entire floor. I'm serious. It was like that weird Twilight Zone episode. You know, the one where the woman's looking for a thimble and she goes to the 13th floor of the department store and the only thing on the floor is just that one thimble? Well, he kept telling us about the people who used to work there on the floor. Made me kind of get a creepy feeling about what he might have done to them. And then he took us to his cubicle. Well, he had a whiteboard with drawings all over it by Art Leonardi, one of the Pink Panther artists. His whiteboard is covered with Pink Panther drawings. It was really cool. Strangely, though, he said all the Pink Panther people who he said were working on the new movie on his floor were oddly gone now, missing as it were. Okay, so it's a little bit creepy, but it's going to be okay. I'm sure everything's fine. So we're still poking around his office when suddenly we notice that standing next to his monitor is an 8x10 framed glossy photo of my family. It was so creepy. It's Kyle and I just both kind of started backing up out of the cubicle, and James just starts laughing his head off and saying he couldn't believe it took us so long to notice it. We nervously kind of laughed along with him. We're pretty sure it was all a joke, right? It was just a joke. I'm sure it was a joke. He seemed perfectly lovely, actually, in person, which is kind of strange. He was kind of snotty to me, and Kyle appreciated that, so that's good. Anyway, I put a few pictures in the show notes of James, Kyle, and I, so if they don't find my body, you'll actually know what James looks like. Well, in the next few weeks, we're going to have a few shakeups on the show. Vacations and trips will be mixing things up, but have no fear, the No Silicast will not falter. I may have to skip a week on podcasting. On podcasting, though, we'll see if I can pull off two shows a week. In fact, I haven't written this week's yet. I better get around to that pretty soon. Well, this next weekend, Bart and I will both be out of town, so there won't be a live chit-chat across the pond, but Bart assures me he'll be able to make a recording to send in of some subject that, takes his fancy. At the end of July, though, I'll be in Mexico on vacation, depending on the free Wi-Fi in the lobby of the hotel, so I can't really count on having enough bandwidth to pull off uploading the show and all that entails. Plus, I'll be snorkeling and enjoying the swim-up bar with 24/7 smoothies. Not sure I'm going to be really interested in working on the show. So, Bart is going to produce the show. The plan right now is that Chit Chat Across the Pond will still take place, but it will be Bart talking to none other than crazy listener James. I know, you're really starting to wonder who's nuts here, aren't you? I keep encouraging him. Well, Bart will probably have to publish the show on Monday, July 28th, rather than Sunday, and that is also counting on me to not screw up any of the directions. What do you think the chances are of me getting all that right as I have to explain it to somebody else? Well, anyway, this is all in the planning stages, so things may change, but that's what we're hoping for right now. Stay tuned as we figure this out.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions.
Dumb questions.
How do I? What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Well, listener Nam pulled out all the stops on his dumb questions this week. He's sent us a whole bunch of them, so let's dig in. He says, "Hi, Allison. So I've been trying to come up with some good dumb questions, if there is such a thing, for your podcast, and I haven't had much luck until today when I tried to play one of your podcasting on podcasting podcasts. What in tarnation is an M4A file, And how do I play it on my cheapy generic MP3 player? Well, now I feel silly for how I addressed the way I was creating podcasting on podcasting. I explained it, but I did it in podcasting on podcasting. You see, an M4A is an audio MP4 file. Does that help? No, that was just mean just to say that. I could go off on a long, drawn-out diatribe on codecs and containers and video stream formats, but let me give the easy answer instead. The file format I'm feeding is an enhanced podcast, which is an audio file that has chapter markers, images as I talk about different items, and then URLs you can actually click on if you're watching the show in iTunes or on the web. I've had a lot of requests for enhanced podcasts for the regular stream over the years, but I've resisted it for just the reasons you cite here. If I do an enhanced podcast that leaves out all the non-iPod players, and having lived my entire computer career in the minority percentage, I refuse to leave anyone out. Now, people have said, you could create two versions of it. You could create one with a podcast track, and then you could hide that and create another version as an MP3. But you know what? I'm tired. It takes a long time to do what I do. So the way I get to the most people is with an MP3 file. I did make an exception to my rule, though, on podcasting on podcasting, because the whole series is explaining how I do podcasting on a Mac. I don't actually know a darn thing about how to do it on Windows, so I'm teaching what I know. If I weren't so lazy or easily confused, I would figure out how to have two feeds, one for the MP3 and one for the M4A, but you know me, I'd probably botch that up and get them all intertangled and you wouldn't be able to get anything. If you really do want to understand the gory details behind M4A, MP4, and the codecs therein, I put a link in the show notes to the Wikipedia entry on the subject. It's actually pretty interesting, but when you're done, you won't be able to remember what anything is. Well, here's Nam's second dumb question. I like these are good. His Windows question. Is there a plain, lightweight, open source calendar program? I don't want to load Outlook or any large planner application. I just want to see the current month, current year, and a few years before and after. I don't need any scheduling, alarms, ability to take notes, or any of that junk. Something like the Unix cal command, like you recently announced on one of your podcasts. Something really simple like the Windows 3.1 bundled calendar program. Well, I know exactly what you're talking about, Nam. Sometimes you just need to know if next Tuesday is the 22nd, and you don't want to get some heavy application there to look it up. I found something that might just do the trick. It's called JSI Calendar. Here's the description. A very simple, view-only calendar for when you just need to look up a date without any fuss. Has options to stay on top, transparency, month-year view toggle, and the ability to select any day as a weekend. Remember settings between usages. Well, I found a place to download it over at PCWorld.com, so I put a link to that in the show notes. I sure hope that does the trick for you. By the way, I did notice that in Vista, if you just click on the time in the bottom right-hand corner, a calendar comes up for that month. I don't know if it's as easy to use, and if you're not using Vista, you might not have that yet. Well, Peter Boots wrote in with a great dumb question. Not sure he meant it as a dumb question, but I thought it fit right in. Hi, Allison. Is there an easy way to send a URL of an interesting podcast I'm listening to a friend right from within iTunes? Greets, Peter. Well, I created a little screen steps tutorial showing Peter how to do it. It's actually pretty simple. In the tutorial, I explained how to find the podcast in iTunes first, but if you already know how to do that, all you have to do is right-click on the image for the podcast in the directory, and it says copy iTunes URL. That's it. If you send someone this URL, it will automatically launch iTunes and direct them right into iTunes directly to click subscribe. I know this was a really simple thing to do, a simple step-by-step procedure, but it's so easy to create these things in screen steps. That's what I did. So go check out the link in the show notes to the tutorial so you can see how cool a screen steps tutorial actually is. Took me maybe 5 minutes to write the entire thing, including screenshots and text and exporting to my website. And it's so pretty. I know I told you I was advertising for these guys, and the reason I'm advertising is because I believe in it and I use it constantly. That whole conversation that I just had here did not start as an advertisement, but rather my natural instinct now is to use screen steps when I want to help people. It was a natural segue into this ad for my sponsor. ScreenSteps is not only a trivially easy tool to create tutorials, answering the question, how do I? It's got a bunch of great ways to export your masterpieces. They have PDF, which is handy for emailing to people, and then they have HTML, which is handy if you manage your own website. Now they've added export directly to your blog right into a new post. ScreenSteps exports directly to TypePad, Movable Type, and WordPress. So after you create that masterpiece, you just right-click on it and choose Export to blog/web. You configure your blog info and the preferences just once, so it's ready for you at all times. I haven't spent a lot of time explaining how ScreenSteps actually works yet. Basically, you turn on recording, go over to the application or the OS trick you want to show or the website you want to explain, and start taking screen snapshots with your favorite tool. The built-in snapshot tool in OS X or Vista could work, or Sketch on the Mac, or Gadwin Print Screen on Windows, whatever tool you like. But if you don't already have a favorite standalone app, you can actually use the one built into ScreenSteps. I really like their tool on Windows in particular, because all the Windows apps seem pretty clumsy to me. Their tool is great because it can either snap right away, or you can set it to have a time delay, where you get to pick the time. And that's critical because it's really useful if you're trying to capture a pull-down menu. You tell it, okay, give me 6 seconds, flip over to the application, pull down the menu, wait, highlight it, and then it's ready to snap the picture, and it pauses with that screen that your pull-down menu pulled down. So that makes it really easy to do great screen snapshots to show menu choices. Okay, so there you are, snapping away as you walk through the thing you want to demonstrate. And as you're snapping away and putting anything into the copy buffer, those snapshots are automatically being pasted into ScreenSteps as separate steps in your tutorial. When you're done snapping away, you go over to ScreenSteps and get down to the meat of the work. Type in a title for each step, type in an explanation for the step, and modify or annotate your snapshot. Well, how many times do you take a shot and there's like the teeny tiny little edge you wish you hadn't clipped? Just crop it in ScreenSteps. Want to draw an arrow or a box around something to draw attention? Just click on the shot, and then a beautiful palette of tools are right there for easy annotation. I should mention that all these things that you draw on top of the pictures are not bitmaps either, so you can adjust them after the fact, widening a box, moving an arrow, that kind of thing. It's so easy, it works just exactly as you'd hope when you get in there. One of my favorite annotation tools they created is unique to ScreenSteps. I've never seen anything like it before. So here's the problem. You've got a menu where the student needs to do a sequence of steps on the menu, right? Click on the sequence button, and everywhere you click, a little yellow circle with a number in it will plop onto the screen. Then in the instructions, you can type the numbers and what they have to do at each step. These numbered balls are intelligent, too. If you put in three of them and then say delete number two, the third ball is going to renumber to take its place. You can move them around and adjust them just like the other annotations. I'm getting carried away here. I'm not supposed to talk this long, but I just have so much fun playing with ScreenSteps. You can tell I can't fake this enthusiasm. When I think something's stupid, you know I'll tell you. But anyway, go look at the simple tutorial I created on how to mail somebody an iTunes URL, and you'll see how cool the output is. If you're sold already, go over to ScreenSteps.com, and when you go to buy, be sure to put in the coupon code NOSILLA, all capital letters, to get 25% off. Well, now back to our regularly scheduled dumb question corner. Listener Lynn asks, maybe this is a dumb question or just lack of understanding on my part. Should I be able to take an existing song, an MP3 or other format, and remove the voice tracks? Or is there another tool? Well, I think this was a great question, perfect for dumb question corner. The problem with a file like an MP3 or any other music file you get is that the music has been mixed down so there aren't really separate tracks to play with anymore. If I sent you, say, a GarageBand file, you could pull out the voice tracks because they're all there still separated to pull out. But it's not possible from an MP3 file or even an uncompressed audio file. Think about it like this. It's like asking if you could pull the yellow paint from an orange painting. The red and yellow have already been mixed together and saved that way. I wanted to verify that what I thought was true, and I found a discussion on the topic over at reasonfreaks.com. It was great because this one guy says, bottom line, you cannot extract vocals out of the actual tracks and never will be. It has been wished upon and talked about millions of times. Sorry, no can do. I guess that puts that to bed, huh? Well, David Hill sent in a great review of a product I'd never heard of. Let's give a listen to that review.
Hi, Allison. This is David from Oklahoma. I'm a recent switcher to the Mac. I bought a 24-inch iMac last year in November from the Apple Refurb store, and now I'm a Mac fanatic. I discovered your podcast in March of 2008, and I really love the show. I like how you include listener audio reviews, so I thought I would send you one of my own. The app I'd like to review is called Tape Deck, and it's from superultramegagroovy.com. And what Tape Deck is, and I'm going to quote from the website, is Tape Deck is a powerful and fun new audio recorder from Mac OS X Leopard, and it's just like your old analog tape recorder, only better, a lot better. Tape Deck really does look like one of those old cassette tape recorders that those of us who grew up in the 80s will remember quite well, the ones that were the size of a phone book, with speakers in the top, tape transport in the middle, and the shuttle controls at the bottom, and a big red record key. I had one of these when I was 11. I got in a lot of trouble with it because I liked to hide it in my sister's room and record her and her friends' conversations. Needless to say, she wasn't very happy, and neither was my mother. Anyway, back to Tape Deck. Tape Deck operates just like the old recorders, complete with fast-forward and rewind buttons that actually let you hear the audio at high speed as it's being rewound and fast-forwarded. It also has stop and pause buttons. There are settings for stereo, mono, as well as high quality, medium quality, and low quality, each of which record at different bit rates. The virtual tapes are recorded as M4A audio files and stored in a folder in your music folder. I did have a bit of trouble recording in stereo, though. While my iMac's built-in microphone was able to make a successful recording in stereo, but when I use my Logitech ClearChat Pro USB headset, I only get sound from the left channel on playback. This is probably not a problem with Tape Deck, but maybe a configuration problem in OS X that I don't have set up just right. But I was able to make a wonderful recording using the mono setting with the headset. That's about it for controls. However, there are a few other settings in the preference pane to set the default folder, location, and toggle on and off the sound effect. You can also have an icon in the menu bar and set up system-wide hotkeys. Now, one of the really cool things, or should I say groovy things, is that Tape Deck has a slide-out drawer on the right side where all your tapes are stored. Tape Deck also has a function where you can share your tapes with others. You simply load the tape you want to share into the recorder and click on File and Email Tape from the menu bar, and Tape Deck will open a new message in your email client and attach the audio file. You can also export your tapes to iTunes and import audio files into Tape Deck. One function that is not available is the ability to edit your audio within Tape Deck. However, I don't find this to be a problem, as an editing function would really go beyond what the app is intended for. Besides, that's what we have GarageBand for. Now, some of the things that I came up with to use Tape Deck for were an audio journal to record quick little thoughts and comments, to take audio notes, and maybe as a family to record an audio scrapbook. And one other idea, which wasn't mine, it was one that I saw someone mention on the support forum, was to use Tape Deck to record copies of vinyl records or old cassettes. All you have to do is hook up your turntable or audio source to your Mac and set the source as the audio input source in the system preferences. I really like Tape Deck, and I'll be using it a lot in the future. As a matter of fact, I recorded this whole review with it. Although I did import it into GarageBand and cut out some bad spots, but that's all, I swear. You can download a demo of Tape Deck at www.tapedeckapp.com. It's shareware and costs $25 to register. As the demo period runs out, Tape Deck playback will start to slow down, just as the old-fashioned recorders did when the batteries got low. Well, that's all I have for Tape Deck. Hope you enjoyed the review, and I hope you have a great holiday weekend.
Well, thanks, David. This sounds like a fun twist on a way to make a good audio recording. Maybe it's kind of silly that they put in those special effects, but it really does make sense the way you explained it. Your audio sounded great, so it's obviously working well with the Mac. And I got to say, congratulations on your switching. You're really jumping into the whole Mac community here quickly, doing a podcast recording already. That's awesome. I put a link in the show notes for everyone else to tapedeckapp.com so you can all go out there and check out this cool application that David recommended. All right, guys, have you gone out and bought a Honda or an Acura yet and moved to Los Angeles or Orange County, California? If you haven't, why the heck not? Because you know that if you had, you'd be able to call Honda Bob and have him come service your car while you lounge in the backyard or play upstairs on the computer. Haven't you been listening? Well, I've had my own car since 1978, and I have only owned Hondas and Acuras because I refused to find a new mechanic. Who else would provide me with excellent in-home care, not make me drive to some creepy shop and sit next to the great unwashed reading 7-year-old copies of Field and Stream? And I bet they charge extra for the bad jokes, too. I get them for free with Honda Bob. Well, those of you brilliant enough to follow my instructions, give Honda Bob a call right away for your next service or repair at 562-531-2321. Or heck, just shoot them an email over at hdabob@aol.com. HEA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. Well, we've talked about phishing on the show before. That's where you get an email from someone pretending to be your bank, or Hallmark for some reason, or whatever site, trying to get you to give up names, passwords, bank account numbers, and other dangerous information. I've explained that in most email systems, maybe all of them now, you can hover over the link they give you, which might look like http://bankofamerica.com, but when you hover over it, you get a little pop-up that shows you that it actually resolves to creepybobscamservice.com instead. Or maybe they're clever and it resolves to paypal.creepybobscamservice.com. You gotta be vigilant and look at that. Well, I use this technique to ensure that I never follow a link without knowing where it really goes. In general, I just throw out every email that ever says anything vaguely like, click here to update your information. Well, this week I got an email from PayPal. Obviously a scam. It says my payments have been suspended because my credit card needs to be updated. Oh, sure, you know, I didn't just fall off the turnip truck, you know. I fell off years ago. So I'm reaching for the delete button when I notice it's a bit more specific than usual. It says my payments to Web Mayhem have been suspended. Well, Web Mayhem is the service Libsyn uses for payments, and that's who I pay every month for serving up my media files for the podcast. Curious, I hover over the link, and it resolves to the real PayPal. Well, I still didn't fall for it. I went to my web browser, in this case Firefox 3. I typed in paypal.com, not clicking on the link in the email. Well, PayPal came up with a comforting bright green bar ensuring that I was at the right site that met the security certificate requirements. And guess what? My credit card info did need to be updated. I'd gotten a new credit card recently, so the expiration date and the secret 3-digit code had expired. Well, I'm telling you this story because one of the statements I and others have made about phishing is that your bank would never send you an unsolicited email telling you to update your personal information. Boy, was I wrong. I guess the lesson here is that you do have to pay attention, not only to ensure that you don't click on a scammer's fake address, but make sure you don't throw away a real email where you really do need to make an update. Do as I do, though. Be cautious, move slowly, think about what it says, and never, ever click the link, even if it does look real. Just do that hover thing to entertain yourself when you find the scams. Go off and type it in yourself. Well, the real comedy is the next day I got a PayPal notice saying my account was suspended, and that one was a phishing scam. It's time for another exciting episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz. How are you doing today, Bart?
I'm doing fine. Well, you've given up on that annoying slash blog thing, I see.
I thought maybe that was played out just a little bit.
Probably just a bit.
Well, I do have the windows open again here because it is hot again. It's not as bad as that week where there was no breeze, but to give you an idea, it was 24 degrees C at 10 o'clock last night, which I think is around 75 degrees.
I love those kind of warm evenings.
Yeah, it was really nice for fireworks. It was just great. So that worked out.
Did you get photographs?
Steve took a bunch of pictures. We'll see how he did. I don't know.
to give an idea what it's like here, I am counting myself exceptionally lucky that I managed to get the grass cut today between the rain.
Oh, wow. Well, it must grow really fast with all that rain.
It does, and you can't cut it. It's a terrible mess. But anyway, it's done. So good
right.
for the week.
Well, there's been a lot of talk on the web about the Trojan horse that hit the Mac community lately, and so we thought maybe we should talk about what that actually means to us. But I wanted to make you start out first by giving us some definitions, because I think it's people mix up viruses with Trojan horses, with spyware, with adware, and they really are very different things. I'm not sure we have to talk about spyware and adware, but if you could help get us a good grounded definition of what is a Trojan horse and what is a virus, I think that would be a good place to start and then kick into what actually happened recently.
Okay, sure. I suppose a Trojan horse is, by its very definition, the easiest type of sort of bad thing to write. What you basically do is you write a bit of software that does what you want, and you tell other people it does what they want, and they run it, and then they end up doing what you want instead of what they want.
Okay.
That's it. So a classic example would be, in the Windows world, it's quite normal to go to a more, shall we say, adult website, be told that there's lots of free stuff here if you'll just download this codec, and then you can see all the nice free stuff. Of course you do, and at that moment, it's installed keyloggers, and it's now sending them back all your credit card numbers and all sorts of nasty things. And you're blissfully unaware, while you may or may not be enjoying whatever the goodies they offered. Poker games are another very common way of sending this kind of stuff, which I believe the Mac one was disguised as a poker program, wasn't it?
Could be. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think it was called Poker something or other. But yeah, so basically, you pretend that you're giving people a screensaver was another classic one. So you offer something that people want, and they think they're getting that, but in actual fact, they're getting that and or, you know, your bad stuff.
Like, but that's not a virus, though. So what's a virus?
Okay, that doesn't propagate. So that entirely, you know, they offer you a gift. They're the Greeks. You're the Trojan. You take it in. You take it into your computer, and all the Greeks come out of the horse and kill you. Okay, that's a Trojan horse. And it stops with you.
Okay.
A virus is a much nastier piece of kit, because for a Trojan horse, you have to open the gates and wheel the horse in, as it were, or run the program.
Okay.
So it involves interaction on your behalf. You do something. Viruses generally don't involve interaction on your behalf, other than, say, maybe receiving an email or whatever, or even opening an email could be enough to get you infected. And a virus won't just sit there and do its bad thing. It will actively go out and seek other computers. And so it spreads.
So
Trojan doesn't spread, but a virus will spread.
So in a way,
so whether
a Trojan
it writes itself into floppy disks, and then you hand out the floppy disks the old way, that's still done through pen drives these days. USB thumb drives are a great way to pass around viruses.
Or grabbing your email address book and sending it to your friends.
Yeah, a lot of viruses travel by email these days, but it doesn't have to be by email. Another classic one within an office environment is to jump around through Windows shares.
Oh, okay. So in a way, a Trojan horse is less scary because we have more personal control over whether it happens to us. It's easier to keep from getting that probably than a virus?
They're both equally as difficult not to get. I'm not sure they're any less scary, to be perfectly honest, except that for a Trojan horse, you know that you've done it. Whereas with the virus, it may have just happened.
Right, that's what I mean by at least you know you have to be an active participant in a Trojan horse, and it's a little less obvious how you caused it to yourself in a virus.
Yeah, but generally speaking, to protect yourself from viruses, it's a case of keeping yourself well up to date. And if there's no security hole for them to bump through, they generally will only get in if you do something, in which case you're back to the same as a Trojan.
Okay.
Of course, the last class we haven't mentioned at all are the most scary of them all, which are worms.
Ooh, what's a worm?
And worms are a subset of viruses that spread through the network. So a really scary worm, basically, one machine on your network gets it, it goes out over the network using some sort of security vulnerability, and it spreads itself to every other machine in your network, spreads itself through the internet. A classic example would be the blaster. Worm,
right.
Which attacked Windows NT variants.
I see.
So,
okay.
Literally, if you had a machine, I've seen it happen within about 30 seconds. There were versions of, I think it was Windows 2000 up to a certain service pack were vulnerable to this because there was a flaw in one of their core services. And so you'd have to go on the internet to download the patch from Microsoft. And just appearing on the internet, there was so much of this worm traffic around that before you had a chance to get the patch downloaded, you were infected.
I heard somebody describe that as being like literally like a virus in your veins that it was just running there all the time, and if you tapped into it, you would get it.
Yeah, that's really how bad some worms have gotten.
Okay, so we've got a bunch of scary stuff here, but we've got an imminent threat right now that we really have to address, right?
Yeah. Now, I wrote a blog post about this, and the reason was that the thing to bear in mind about a Trojan is it does not require any sort of a security vulnerability in your operating system.
Oh.
Hypothetically speaking, let us imagine, and there is no such operating system, but let us imagine that there was not a single solitary security hole in the entirety of Mac OS X. Not realistic, but let's just imagine. You would still be 100% vulnerable to Trojans. That's scary.
Well, how would that be?
Okay. When you run a program, that program can do anything you can do. A Trojan is just a program that you run that's pretending to be something else. So it says, you know, it's calling itself, you know, codec.exe or whatever, but in actual fact, it happens to be a keylogger. You run it. It's running as you. What can you do on your computer? You can create files, you can delete files, you can edit files, you can read files, you can start programs, you can start stuff automatically every time you log in, you can contact the network. So a Trojan can do all of those things to all of your files.
And you can let that in just because you actively went out and got it. It wasn't a hole in the operating system. It was a hole in your brain.
It's not a hole. You ran a program. The program could do anything you can do.
Okay.
It just so happens that the person who sold you the program lied to you about what it does.
Okay.
That's all a Trojan is. It's just someone tells you this is a game, whereas in actual fact, it's a keylogger or whatever.
So the Trojan that came out for the Mac recently is not exploiting a vulnerability? Or is it?
Okay. It is.
Okay.
So it can do, a Trojan can do all of that damage without any vulnerability whatsoever. It can destroy your life, literally. It can, if it runs a keylogger, it can get your bank details, get your security, your social security number, it can steal your identity, and it can steal your money. So that, to me, counts as ruining your life.
Right. That's pretty bad.
It can do all of that without any security hole whatsoever. Now, if there is something called a privilege escalation vulnerability, it can do so to all the users of your Mac and not just to you.
So if you were running as not an administrator, but you got this Trojan horse, it could escalate your privileges from a normal user to an administrator?
Yeah, that's what a privilege escalation vulnerability is.
Okay.
So literally, the program would use a security flaw to make itself an admin, even though it shouldn't be, and without popping up a prompt for your password. So silently becoming an admin.
Hmm.
And there is such a vulnerability. It's the ARD vulnerability that you hear a lot about.
So it doesn't have to, I don't have to give it the root password for it to escalate to being root?
That's because there's a flaw in OS X at the moment that Apple haven't patched yet.
Yikes!
And that whole class of flaw is called privilege escalation. But the way you should look at that is, in the case of Trojans, it's the difference between something being disastrously bad or very disastrously bad.
Okay. I'm feeling good already. I'm going to go shoot myself now. Thanks, Bart.
No, but the reason I'm mentioning this is because I've seen a lot of stuff out on the internet where people are seeing, there's a Trojan for the Mac. This is bad. That Trojan is using the flaw in ARD Agent. Therefore, if I plug the flaw in ARD Agent, I'm safe. And the logic doesn't work like that.
Hmm.
Okay, so people are skipping over the Trojan bit, going straight to flaw, plug flaw, therefore safe. Not true.
Okay, so how do we become safe then?
There is no way to become safe other than to never, ever, ever install something from an untrusted source, ever.
What's a trusted source? That always bugs me when people say that, because, I mean, I trust you, Bart. If you send me something, is that okay?
Yeah, because, yeah, it comes down to who you trust. The more, honestly, it's the same as would you buy something off a vendor on the street? You know, do you trust them or not? There is no there's no objective way of saying you're trustworthy or not.
Okay.
You build up trust relationships with people and with websites.
Okay.
Some websites, by definition, will be more trustworthy. You know, if you're listening to Twit and Leo Laporte tells you that such and such is a great utility, I personally would be inclined to trust Leo and would take his word for it. Whereas if I went to a site that was full of banner ads for all sorts of nasty things and they said, why don't you download this cool program? I wouldn't trust them.
I think a good example of where I used that logic was Namdar asked me for a calendar program, and I thought, and I went out and I found this thing on PC World, and I looked at it and I said, okay. And then I went to the guy's website, and the guy's website was literally two lines. It was click here to download this. And had I found that on its own, I would not have clicked download this. But since I found it on PC World first, then I said, okay, this is probably all right.
Yeah, really, it comes down to the case of the old idea of I'm going to Google for what I want and just take Google's word for it and run whatever Google tells me is good. Those days are gone. That is not a safe thing to do. All you can do is Google for it, and only if you find recommendations on places like, websites that you trust, would you then go and actually download it. You know, you can't just blindly run stuff.
Now,
whether it comes in through email or whether you find it on Google, you just, you know, your default should be not to trust, and then you should look for reasons to trust.
Well, that's a good example there where I did Google it and I found it and it said had the big PC World banner, but I did not take that for granted. I looked at the URL to make sure I was really at PC World first.
Oh, yes, very much so. That's a very good point. Yeah, because anyone can give a fake review, I guess.
So for Mac users, would you call Version Tracker a trusted site?
Personally, I wouldn't.
Oh, shoot.
Because it takes minutes to get your software up on Version Tracker. Now, I don't know how quick Version Tracker would be at removing something that had known malware in it, but I would tend to go on recommendations. I don't install stuff I haven't heard recommended on a podcast at this stage. Because there's so many great podcasts out there. The Mac community is fantastic.
Now, how do you know,
trust the community is how I would look at it.
Well, how do you know that Version Tracker is easy to get your stuff up on quickly? I had the assumption that they did some sort of vetting process, that they looked at it before they posted it there.
I don't think they do. I'm pretty sure at some stage, I could be wrong now. It's been a while since I've looked into this kind of stuff. But I had written a small little dashboard widget at some stage, which I got onto a bunch of tracking sites, and I don't remember any of them ever checking anything. It was fill in this automated form, upload the zip file, and you're done. Thanks very much. So I'm afraid to say, my personal advice is trust the community.
What about, so you wouldn't trust Mac Update either?
No, I don't like big aggregator sites. I prefer to keep the community stuff.
Okay.
Now, having said that, I would tend to trust something on SourceForge, but I could be bitten by that.
I would trust it on SourceForge if I looked at the number of downloads and it was 12,962. If it's 7, might wait a little bit and see how they're doing.
Yeah, that's also true. But really, I think it really does come down to trust the community. The annoying thing is, you can't install software to protect from a Trojan, because a Trojan is not breaking anything security-wise. It is doing what you can do, which is exactly what it's supposed to be doing. There is no way to protect from it software-wise. There's no way to protect from a Trojan. You can't run some quick software to just tell you that's a Trojan that isn't.
Okay.
The only protection is ever-present vigilance. It's really annoying. There is no silver bullet at all. And the annoying thing, in the past, the bad guys didn't care about the Mac. Therefore, didn't matter. We didn't have to be careful, because if the bad guys weren't after us, then there was no bad stuff there, and we could carry on. But I'm afraid that those days are gone. The bad guys are aware that we have a fairly substantial market share now. I think it was approximately 8% according to NetApp this week. And they're going after us. And what's worse is that of all the users in the entire world, I think the least security savvy would tend to be the Mac community, because they've never had to worry about it before.
Right. Oh, I'm sure I'm going to be the first one hit, because I just go out and I download everything. It tends to usually come from someone saying, hey, try this. This looks cool.
Yeah, but the thing is, you're very in touch with the community, so I actually don't think you will be the first hit, because you'll know that there's a Trojan doing the rounds.
Yeah, that's...
because it will make its way around the community.
That's true. By the way, while we were talking, I just went to a site called darkreading.com that's talking about don't download strange software, download from untrusted sources. And they say, unlike LimeWire and sites like that and other peer-to-peer networks, Version Tracker doesn't allow for anonymous software postings, and there is at least a basic vetting process for software. No one can guarantee perfect safety, but Version Tracker's done a solid job thus far.
Okay, so glad to hear that.
That's a little... I might have written that, so I don't know whether these people know what they're talking about or not.
Yeah, that's also true. But no, there is no 100% safety. It's just apply your common sense and take risks as you feel appropriate. If you're on a machine that belongs to work and has 5,000 credit card numbers on it, don't take any risks whatsoever.
Right.
If you're on your own machine, which you've never used for internet banking, which you don't do any e-commerce on whatsoever, it contains about 2 photographs and that's it, do whatever you want.
And those photographs, you don't mind being on the cover of a magazine somewhere.
Well, yeah, that's true. As long as they're not compromising photographs.
Oh, by the way, I just checked the date on that article I was just reading from. It was from 2006, so I don't know if that's still true or not.
Yeah, like I say, basically, the point of this whole discussion is to tell people to always be suspicious, always be careful, and bear in mind that we are targets now. The time for smugness about Mac security is over.
That makes me sad.
It makes me sad too, but it's true.
Yep.
I guess the only place you can be smug is on Linux.
People did say they would be depressed when we started to get big numbers. By the way, the numbers in the home market, I've heard from a couple of sources, at least in the U.S., is around 20%. So businesses where you probably aren't going to get a lot of vulnerabilities because of the more protection because of an IT group and that sort of thing is where this, you know, the big numbers of Windows users are. So I think it's even higher in the local, you know, home market.
Yeah. No, there's a lot of people out there using Macs, definitely. And those people may be a little tempted to just download anything and run anything. Those days are gone. Forget about it. It's like, there was a time when you could buy a magazine and just run the CD that came with it and not worry. Those days didn't last long on the PC end.
All right. Well, any other advice on that, or is that our depressing news for the day?
I'm afraid to say that there is no silver lining on this one. It is ever-present vigilance. If you're a fan of the Harry Potter books, think Mad-Eye Moody barking, ever-present vigilance. Just, that's the advice. And don't be, don't lose sight of things. Yes, the current Trojan uses a privilege escalation vulnerability to become even more dangerous than unbelievably very. Okay, so plugging the hole doesn't protect you.
Right. I find it interesting. My father-in-law is very careful and very suspicious and ever vigilant. And he showed me where he got an email from a friend of his that had an attachment at the end. So he clicked it and he got really angry that his friend had sent him something that when he looked it up on Google appeared to be a virus. I said, you clicked on it. If you had been on Windows, you would have just done it to all of your friends. You cannot yell at this guy. You can tell him that he's got a problem. He's got some, it was adware or something like that. And I said, you can go tell him he got some adware, but you cannot call him stupid for clicking that because you clicked it too. You just got lucky and did it on a Mac.
Yeah, definitely. No, it's ever-present vigilance. That reminds me of another thing that really annoys me, that it's become the norm. Like, there are social networking sites which will ask you, please give me your Google password, your Gmail password. Don't. Ever. Ever, ever, ever. Think about it. When you sign up to a bulletin board system, you use your email address, and then they send you the password. And if you ever forget your password on any site, what do? You enter your email and you click the Forgot Password button. So once someone controls your email, they control your entire online persona.
Hmm.
And it just scares the hell out of me that large corporations like Bebo are asking for this. Bebo asked me for it yesterday. Annoyed the hell out of me. And now we have scammers asking for it. And a couple of friends of mine were hit by it, and we all got emails, of course, trying to get us to sign up to the social networking site. I've had loads of them at this stage, so I know loads of my friends have stupidly entered in the information, unfortunately. And it's because big sites like Bebo make it acceptable to do this. It's not. Don't do it, please.
I don't think I've ever seen that.
You should send snotty emails to people who ask you for it. Like, Bebo are getting a piece of my mind over this.
I don't believe I've ever been asked for a password to a different site. I can't remember that happening, so...
Well, the way they say it is, find your friends, log in to give us your Gmail login, and we'll look at your address book and tell you what their usernames are here on Bebo.
I have seen that. Yeah, I definitely have
seen
that.
So you give them your Gmail username and your Gmail password, and they go off and read your address book. But they can do anything they want with it. You have to trust that they're going to destroy that. You have to trust that they have good security in place. You're trusting an awful lot there. You're basically placing your entire online persona in the hands of a company who are imperfect. That goes for every company. They're all imperfect. So you're exposing yourself to a significant risk for very little to gain, if any. And it's a habit I would strongly advise people to get out of.
Hmm. Yeah, definitely. That doesn't sound like a good plan.
No.
Well, in light of all this, I wanted to ask you about whether I saw the upgrade to 10.5.4 come out this last week, and then every Twitter I got was somebody saying, oh, no, I've got a gray screen of death. And I got a Twitter from you saying you'd had problems. It seemed like a lot of people having problems. Should I do that upgrade? It sounds kind of scary.
It is kind of scary. I will say it sorted itself out. I didn't have to do anything. It just time magically healed my machine.
What was your symptom?
But no, my symptom was that the Finder wouldn't launch. It would just sit there with a pinwheel.
I hate when
the pinwheel
happens.
Went away after 25 minutes, and it's never come back.
Wow, that's kind of creepy.
But it worried me, because everything else was working fine, so I was using my machine, I just couldn't do anything in the Finder. I was like, I need to move a file, but I can't.
Well, you didn't just pop open the terminal and do it there?
Well, as it happens, I did, but, I mean...
Come on, I went 3 days without a Finder one time, you know.
It's not pleasant, though.
No, it wasn't at all. It's not what you buy
but
a Mac
yeah.
for.
So I have three machines, it only happened on one, and it did sort itself. I haven't personally come across anyone who's had an actual disaster. Just a couple of moments.
Okay, so they were just short-term problems, huh?
Yeah, but the thing to bear in mind when you're deciding whether or not to do it is that 10.5.4 contains, bundled in with it, security update 2008-004, which has 13 bug fixes. Two of them in particular scared me. I'll read you a little quote from them. The Samba one allows, quote, a remote attacker may be able to cause an unexpected application termination or arbitrary code execution, which translates into English as, put your machine in the network and it could be completely hacked.
Oh.
Because one of the other vulnerabilities is a privilege escalation vulnerability. So you can if you combine arbitrary code with privilege escalation, you have total ownage, really.
So that's worth a chance on a gray screen of death?
Yeah, you know, it gets worse. That's one of the scary ones. The other scary one is a vulnerability in WebKit, which, quote, visiting a maliciously crafted website may lead to an unexpected application termination or arbitrary code execution. In other words, visit the wrong website and you're completely owned.
Yeah. So maybe when I'm done recording this and I run a backup to make sure I haven't lost the recording, I might run that update while I go to the beach.
I would advise it, to be honest, because once their security fix is out, it's very easy for the bad guys to reverse engineer the fix to find the problem off in case.
Right.
We haven't seen it on the Mac, but on Windows, there's now, you're familiar with the phrase Microsoft instituted called Patch Tuesday.
Right.
So the first Tuesday of every month, they release their patches. There's now a new thing called, Malware Thursday, basically, where by the Thursday, all the bad guys have reverse-engineered the patches and are actively exploiting the holes Microsoft just fixed. Mm. Hasn't been happening on the Mac, but it will. It's just a matter of time. So, you know, it's important. I would suggest, from a security point of view, if you use Windows file sharing or if you surf the net, that you update. And I think that covers a lot of people.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
The other thing...
They're also worried about the zero-day exploit, right, where they get it on the same day it comes out. That's the one people are worried about?
No, zero-day is even worse. Zero-day means that the bad guys find it before the good guys find it. So the first time we know about it is when it's being in use maliciously.
I would call that the negative one day.
Yeah, it's an interesting term, zero-day, but basically zero-day means that the bad guys get it first. Zero-days are bad. Zero-days are always bad. We haven't had a serious issue with a zero-day on the Mac, but I'm afraid to say it's probably a matter of when, not if.
Hmm.
This is a very depressing show this week.
I was just going to say, and that'll wind up the most depressing episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond.
I can be a little more depressing if you like.
No.
well, the fix, the 10.5.4 does not fix the ARD agent privilege escalation vulnerability.
So be expecting 10.5.5 shortly?
Rumor has it it's due shortly anyway, yeah. Or just a standalone security update. But yeah, basically, ever-present vigilance. That's it. We can condense this entire half hour, however long we've been rambling, into those two words. Three words. Four words? Ever-present vigilance. Three words.
All right. On that note, I think we will wind up this most depressing episode. And after you finish listening to this, you know, go run dispermissions first and then fix dispermissions, install the update, fix dispermissions and pray.
I have never done any of that kind of rubber chicken stuff. I've just always closed down my applications, installed it, and that was it.
Really?
Okay. Maybe that's why I had a trouble, of course.
Could be. I know it's recommended by people who are good at this stuff, like Steve Stanger, but I sometimes remember to do it.
To me, it always strikes me as like that, you know, you should start every week by defragmenting your Windows hard drive, which to me, it always struck me as complete garbage. I could be wrong, of course. Don't take my word for it, but I don't do it.
All right. Well, I've got to, before I go, shoot myself for how depressing this was, I think I'm going to cut us off here, Bart.
Okie dokie. Until next week, safe computing.
Aww. Well, I hope that wasn't too depressing of an episode, but, you know, it's important to listen to what Bart says and do the right things here. Just like that phishing scam thing, we got to stay ever vigilant, right? Well, I cannot believe I got the show out on time this week. I was way behind by about 3 o'clock, 3:30, something like that on Sunday. And I'm sitting here and Rob Hansen was on iChat. And so we start goofing around and we were trying to get iChat Theater to work. And we started launching all these other programs. I should have been writing the podcast. And then Kyle asked me to play ping pong. So we played again. Hey, I actually beat him twice in the last 25 games. So I'm coming along. Then I realized I hadn't washed my car yet or finished up writing my notes. Oh, no. But I still got her done. Well, if you've been thinking about shooting off an audio review, now is a great time as the summer gets into full gear, and I want to go outside and play more ping pong. Send them off to nosilicast@gmail.com. Try to keep them under 5 minutes if you can. That seems to be a sweet spot, like the 3 to 5 minute range. If you want to send in written comments or suggestions or dumb question corner, lavish praise on me or Bart or the reviewers who work so hard on the show, send those emails off to allison@podfeet.com. Keep an eye on my antics by following me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Don't forget to check out the live recording on Sunday nights on Ustream at 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time or GMT-8 for the rest of you. And there you just go over to ustream.tv/nosilicast. I usually shoot out a little notice on Twitter right before I go on the air. And then don't forget Facebook and LinkedIn and Plurk and Flibble and, oh, my time to go. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.